Hi, I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters Today on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we've got a terrific show, I think, for you. I think as we've spoken about on Media Matters several times in the past 2 months, there's a book that's worked its way up the bestseller list by a guy named Bernard Goldberg, a former or current producer, I think, for CBS News, which recounts the conservative, his view that there's a liberal bias in the news media that's hostile to conservatives. And it's gotten a lot of play in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, really all the news media and television as well. Another book has also been released in the last couple of months that has similarly done extraordinarily well, but I think with much less fanfare. This book is called Into the Buzzsaw, and it's a collection of a number of essays by award-winning journalists, for the most part, on their experiences dealing with censorship as they've tried to cover some tough stories over the past 10 or 15 years. Today in Media Matters, we're very fortunate to have, as our guest, the editor of that book, Christina Borgeson, and one of the contributors to the book, Gary Webb. And let me briefly introduce them, if I may. Christina Borgeson has been an independent producer and writer for almost 20 years. She's worked for numerous news shows, including on CBS News, and produces and co-hosts the Expert Witness radio show on WBAI in New York City. She's won an Emmy and a Murrow Award for her investigative journalism. Christina, are you there?
I'm here.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today on Media Matters.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And also with us, and Christina's talking to us from New Jersey, with us on the line from California, is Gary Webb, who was an investigative reporter for 19 years, focusing on government and private sector corruption. He has won more than 30 journalism awards, including a Pulitzer Prize. Formerly, he worked at the San Jose Mercury News. He's now a consultant to the California State Legislature's Joint Audit Committee. Gary, are you here?
Yes, I am.
Well, thank you, too, for joining us very much. And what I'd like to do, before we go much further, is I'd like to start, if I can, by reading a passage from Gary Webb's chapter in the book, Into the Buzzsaw. Because, Gary, I think you in many ways are the, I wouldn't say the best known, but your story probably has received the most attention over the past 5 years. It's in the book, or one of them, certainly. And I think I'd like to read the first couple of pages, of a couple of paragraphs from what you wrote to give sort of a sense, because I think it sums up in many ways what most of the journalists could have written. You wrote something that was true, I think, of almost every essay in this book, and I'll read it to you right now. Gary Webb from Into the Buzzsaw. If we had met 5 years ago, you wouldn't have found a more staunch defender of the newspaper industry than me. I'd been working at daily newspapers for 17 years at that point, doing no-holds-barred investigative reporting for the bulk of that time. As far as I could tell, the beneficial powers the press theoretically exercised in our society weren't theoretical in the least. They worked. I wrote stories that accused people and institutions of illegal and unethical activities. The papers I worked for printed them, often unflinchingly, and many times gleefully. After these stories appeared, matters would improve. Crooked politicians got voted from office or were forcibly removed. Corrupt firms were exposed and fined. Sweetheart deals were rescinded. Grand juries were impaneled. Indictments came down. Grafters were bundled off to the big house. Taxpayers saved money. The public interest was served. In 17 years of doing this, nothing bad had happened to me. I was never fired or threatened with dismissal if I kept looking under rocks. I didn't get any death threats that worried me. I was winning awards, getting raises, lecturing college classes, appearing on TV shows, and judging journalism contests. So how could I possibly agree with people like Noam Chomsky and Ben Bagdikian, who were claiming the system didn't work, that it was steered by powerful special interests and corporations, and existed to protect the power elite? Hell, the system worked just fine, as far as I could tell. It encouraged enterprise. It rewarded muckraking. And then I wrote some stories that made me realize how sadly misplaced my bliss had been. The reason I'd enjoyed such smooth sailing for so long hadn't been, as I'd assumed, because I was careful and diligent and good at my job. It turned out to have nothing to do with it. The truth was that in all those years, I hadn't written anything important enough to suppress. That was Gary Webb from the introduction or to the beginning of his chapter of Into the Buzzsaw. And Gary, what was it that you wrote about that got you into hot water?
A series about CIA links to drug trafficking and the outbreak of the crack epidemic in Los Angeles in the 80s. And as I sat here listening to those words read back to me, I'm still sort of stunned that that it all occurred. I mean, I fully expected to be a newspaper reporter till my dying day. And And it really was. I really was a true believer. And I still am to some degree. I mean, there are people out there that are still fighting the good fight, but I think by and large the media has, you know, those people have lost the battle.
I'd like to hear more about your story. Let me tell our listeners, though, if you want to call in and talk to Christina Borgeson or Gary Webb, the number here at the station, 333-9455, or our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. Now, Gary, just go through your story a little more, because I suspect a lot of our listeners are unfamiliar with it. It was 1996, and after a year or two of research,
a year,
you broke a multi-part story in the San Jose Mercury News about the involvement of the CIA with the cocaine trade in Central America that had led to the dealer
right.
who brought the crack cocaine into North America. Is that right?
Yeah, it was sort of a chain reaction. I mean, the series was about a drug ring, essentially, that was bringing cocaine into South Central Los Angeles right at the start of the crack outbreak down there. And it was about who these men were and how crack got started in L.A. and who they were. They turned out to be working with the CIA organization called the Contras to sell cocaine to raise money for a war down in Nicaragua that they were running. And it was really, we sort of tracked this drug from the streets back to where it began, and that's sort of what the series was about. And over the course of 3 days, it explained how this cocaine had come into South Central right when people were learning how to turn it into crack. And, you know, as the series showed, and we had pictures and we had documents, CIA agents knew what was going on. They were actively involved in some cases in helping this outfit bring the cocaine in the United States. And they were essentially shielded from prosecution because they were working on projects in furtherance of U.S. foreign policy. I mean, you don't find too many drug dealers who are all that interested in politics, except maybe in Colombia. But in this case, they were helping out U.S. foreign policy, and the United States government sort of turned a blind eye to their activities while they were doing that.
We're talking to Gary Webb and Christina Borgeson. Christina's the editor of the new book, Into the Buzzsaw. Gary's one of the contributing authors. It's a book basically exploding the myth or exposing the myth of a free press in the United States. Now, Gary, in your story, what was interesting, I think, and one of the most striking parts about it was not the story itself. I mean, that's a great news story, don't get me wrong, but rather the response of the rest of the news media to it once it came out.
I agree.
I mean, in theory, what's supposed to happen is when an investigative journalist breaks open a story like you did there, you hope that it will set off a healthy competition with the other major news media, putting their own people on it, trying
and
to push
it. It did for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
It actually did for a little while. I mean, you actually had NBC News for the first time in his life, I think, pointing out that there were entries regarding drug shipments in Oliver North's diaries. That was a follow that NBC News did a couple of weeks after this became a big story. I thought finally this decade-long of silence about this topic was finally broken open,
mm-hmm.
and it was. It became a big topic of discussion, so much so that there was this counterattack to shut it back down again. And I think what was happening in this case was the government couldn't do it itself, which is a lot of times what they do. They just deny access, they stonewall, you never get anything, therefore your story never gets quote-unquote proven. But government denials in this case weren't going to quiet the public because the government was, according to my stories, was complicit in this.
Mm-hmm.
It was like asking one of the co-conspirators if it was true or not. So in this case, I think the media took up that role. To defend the government, defend the status quo, and say, you know, basically pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. We've investigated this thoroughly, and we're convinced there's nothing here. And, you know, when you have the major media organizations in the country saying that, after a while people become confused, and in this case they did.
And it led to the, if I'm not mistaken, to eventually your own newspaper, the San Jose Mercury News, doing a page one.
It wasn't a page one. It was sort of on the front of the editorial page.
Okay.
It was a letter to the readers from the editor who had, you know, for 9 months wholeheartedly supported this and, you know, wrote memos defending the series against the stories in the Washington Post. One day turning around and saying, well, I think that there were some gray areas. That was the way he phrased it. And it wasn't that it was wrong because, you know, all the facts were correct. never once did we correct any single fact in that story. We were even asked to. He found problems with the tone and the implications and all these sort of squishy areas that it's kind of hard to argue about. Once the debate leaves the field of fact versus falsehood and gets into what people might have been able to read or were assuming that these stories said, and that's basically what his story was about, that we had written a lot of things that led people to assume, for instance, that the CIA knew about this. Well, of course we did. I mean, that was the whole point of the story. But the rest of the media treated it as if it was a retraction, and frankly my own newspaper did, even though they claimed that it wasn't.
Yeah, in fact, the reason I said page one was that the New York Times put it on page one.
The New York Times put it on the front
page.
That's
right.
Yeah. Along with a glowing editorial that said how courageous my editors were for backing away from the story that they couldn't find one factual error in.
Well, in a way, you'd almost think the New York Times and the other leading news media were, in a way, they almost have to do that, because if, in fact, they follow up a story and say, this is a great story, the logical question is, why did it take you 10 years to cover something this important?
And the factual answer is that they knew about it at the time and decided not to,
mm-hmm.
which was my great fault with the media. And I pointed that out in the television radio appearances I made afterwards. One of the first questions I was asked when this story broke was by a DJ in Washington, D.C., and he said, and this was a period of time after the series had come out and there was dead silence. Nobody was responding to it. And he said, do you think that if this story had appeared on the front page of the Washington Post or the New York Times, there would be a public outrage over it? And I said, well, you know, that assumes it ever would have appeared on the front page of those newspapers, and I don't think it ever would have. When I began researching it, I discovered that there were reporters out there like Bob Perry and Brian Barger of the Associated Press who had been trying to make this an issue back in the 80s when it was going on, which was very courageous of those guys to actually take on a drug ring that was actively operating. And their stories were ignored and dismissed and run on page 821, and it never went anywhere because the big papers wouldn't get off their butts and take a look at it. And because they were afraid of taking on the Reagan administration. So when this thing comes up in a little paper on the West Coast in the 90s, you're right. The logical question is, where were our big newspapers when this stuff was going on, when they could have written about it, when it would have made a difference?
That's right. We're talking to Gary Webb and Christina Borgeson today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. If you want to call in and talk about the state of journalism, investigative journalism in particular, in the United States, in the sorry state, if you were to read into the buzzsaw, and we're going to talk about it this hour, please call us at 333-9455 or the toll-free number 800-222-9455. Christina, thanks for holding on the line as you have.
Well, thank you. Listen, I just want to add a comment to, Gary and his story. I work with a former DEA agent, Mike Levine, who's also one of the contributors to the book, who ran into the buzzsaw while he was trying to bust the cartel heads in Latin America, only to discover, by practically losing his life, that these were CIA assets. Okay, and I just had to laugh when I was listening to Gary. I don't know whether to laugh or cry, but we talk about these things on our radio, which is a community radio where we fundraise, and one of the fundraising premiums that we were offering this time around was a copy of a page of Oliver North's diary where he writes down that he has to send for an airplane to pick up 15 pounds of cocaine paste in Latin America. So, I mean, here's a perfect example. I mean, Oliver North is a guy who is now, sort of this quasi-national hero, and the guy's he's a criminal, He's a criminal. There's absolute proof of that fact.
Mm-hmm.
But the media, the major media in this country portrayed him as some kind of, backwards hero. Or
yeah, super patriot.
Exactly.
The Andy Jackson from upstate New York.
Exactly. Where there's absolute proof that this guy was drug dealing so that he could make money for the, so that he could help fund the Contras, which was also an illegal activity.
When the CIA finally after my stories came out, the CIA did an internal investigation, which to this date is the only official investigation that's ever been done. And they came up with some very interesting memos. They interviewed this, and these were interviews that were done contemporaneously with this drug operation going on. And they interviewed this fellow in Costa Rica about drug trafficking and any involvement in drug trafficking he might have had with the Contras. And his answer was that he found it very difficult to answer any questions about drug trafficking because he had been working with the National Security Council on some special projects. And therefore, he didn't know what really to tell them. So instead of, when this information got back to Washington, instead of launching an immediate investigation, the government launched an immediate cover-up and said, don't talk to this man anymore, do not interview him again, leave him alone, and be quiet, and this is somebody else's problem. That was the CIA's response to the information that the NSC might have been involved in drug trafficking. And
you know, that's the thing is, you know, the general public, people out there, you know, in Urbana, they're probably listening to this and they're going, what?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that was my reaction when I first heard it, too. It's like,
exactly.
This is too incredible to be believed.
Exactly. I mean, that's the thing. That's the thing about a lot of these stories, but particularly the stories that cover the activities of our major law enforcement agencies.
And I think three or four of the chapters in the book do that, if I'm not mistaken.
Pardon me?
Three or four of the chapters in the book.
Well, yeah, I mean, to me it was breathtaking to receive Gary Webb's, Michael Levine's, and John Kelly's chapters, which together form a triad that is just the biggest indictment of the operations and of the activities of the CIA that I have ever seen on paper. And really, I mean, these are people, Gary went through what he went through. You know, Mike Levine was a DEA agent. He lived the story and almost died because of the story that he tells, okay? And John Kelly uses the government's own documents to show that the CIA admits to actively breaking 100,000 serious laws every year around the world to do what they do, which nobody knows what they do because nobody gets access to any significant information about their activities.
Well, in the last 6 years, since it's been almost 6 years now since Gary's story was released or published by the San Jose Mercury News, how many investigative reports have there been on the CIA by U.S. news media? Have there been any that have followed it?
Of the major media?
Yeah.
Jeez.
Well, there were some stories shortly afterwards about the activities in Honduras with the death squads in there. Actually, the Baltimore Sun did a great series on this death squad battalion down in Honduras that the CIA was operating. But again, you know, it was in the Baltimore Sun, and nobody else picked it up.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some calls for investigations, and I think there might have even been, little investigations done by some congressional subcommittee. But that's another example. Nobody really wants to know, especially the big newspapers. They don't want to know what the CIA is doing. They seem very comfortable with the idea that, you know, this is an agency where, well, for example, you have the Washington Post at the time my series came out. They had a man named Walter Pincus covering the CIA for them. He'd been covering them for 20 years. And Walter Pincus was the man who wrote the first attacks on my series for the Post. And I got a letter from a reader down in Southern California who said, you know, look up this story that your newspaper published back in 1964 or something. And it was called, what was the title of it? How I Traveled Abroad for the CIA, and the byline was Walter Pincus. And it was about his work as a propagandist for the Central Intelligence Agency during the 50s and the 60s. So
well, there's
how interested the Post is in covering the CIA. Seriously,
well,
they put a former CIA informant on the beat.
There is research to be done on journalists working for major media, both newspapers and TV, who are actually working for the CIA. I mean, that's not a conspiracy buff thing. I mean, that's a fact.
That's an empirical question.
And exactly. And, you know, but the fact of the matter is, And certainly network television never, ever, ever looks into these things in any substantive way. I mean, just absolutely never.
No, they do a series on how great the CIA is.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and then they actually do. Are you talking about that new series,
the
entertainment? Well, I'm talking about the news division.
Yeah,
I mean,
well,
they
it's
never
hard
do
to
any
distinguish
substantive
anymore.
Work. Yeah, right. But it's a bad thing for the American public, and obviously for our democracy, as you well know, Bob. But you know, the American public has to start realizing that, you know, particularly in these dangerous times, post 9/11, the questions do have to be asked. You know. And we do have to be apprised. I mean, not to the point where we screw up good operations that are doing good things. But the fact of the matter is, you know, the CIA has in its history, if you really look at it closely and talk to people who have actually been involved, they've done more harm than good in many cases.
And some spectacular foreign policy blunders that they've pulled off over the years that, you know, we still live with today.
Gary, Christina, let me just stop here for a second to let our listeners know they're listening to Media Matters. I'm the host, Bob McChesney. You're listening to Gary Webb and Christina Borgeson. They've got a new book out. Christina's the editor of it, called Into the Buzzsaw, Leading Journalists Expose the Myth of a Free Press. Gary has a chapter in it. If you'd like to call in and talk about the state of journalism today, the number is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. And we've got a caller from Champaign. Hi, you're on the air with Christina and Gary.
Thank you. Yeah, I want to applaud your work, and I've read Gary's book about the whole drug and CIA connection. And you know, I think that it's great that some of this stuff comes out. I think that Greg Palast's book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, is great, and at the same time, I'm still very frustrated because so few people, you know, really know about this stuff or are ever going to read those books, and many others that are out there. And you know, in some ways, I still find it very frustrating. You know, in the case of Gary's book, even that, you know, it took so long, even for him to come across this. I mean, he talks about that in his book, but I was involved with the Christic Institute many years earlier, who was trying to get that whole story out.
And you saw how the media responded to that effort.
Well, not only that, but the Institute was sued out of existence.
Right.
Oh, that's a common ploy for a lot of sensitive stories. Very common ploy.
I mean, I at least take some pride that I managed to irritate some of those people. I made some agitprop art. It was sort of a parody of traveler's checks, where I put Oliver North's face in where the Trojan soldier's face was, and you know, had it countersigned by Ronald Reagan and Richard Secord, and had a parody of the CIA emblem on the back with the eagle snorting cocaine, and then their story about what, this is entitled American Excess Checks instead of American Express. But anyway, American Express, after we distributed about 40,000 of them, decided that there was copyright infringement and told us to stop, and I guess I was personally denounced by General Secord is some sort of terrorist, but you know,
you can always put that on your resume.
Yeah,
that's right.
Right. But you know, you should. I mean, really, the best thing is for people like him who really are informed to just talk to everybody. You know, just spread the word, even if it's, you know, when you go to church or when you go to the grocery store or whatever. You know, these are the things people think it makes no difference whatsoever, but it actually does.
Well, but you know, even then, a lot of times people still won't believe you. In fact, last night I was having an argument with somebody who didn't vote for Bush, doesn't like Bush, but still wouldn't believe me when I was trying to spell out how, you know, it's been exposed how the election was stolen in Florida. And, you know, I said, well, it's just opinion, you know, you don't have any real evidence and stuff, but, you know, can I get him to read?
I think you have to build a head of steam, and you know, in a sense, what's going on now I think is making people focus more and more on the quality of information they are receiving from the mainstream media. I have no doubt about that, because now the mainstream media is now catching up with the independent media, who've been reporting ever since before 9/11 that you know, some horrendous terrorist activity was going to happen. And after 9/11, we're asking immediately, you know, where were the CIA, where were the FBI, where was our nation? You know, I mean, a plane being able to fly right into the Pentagon. I mean, where were our law enforcement agencies when all this was being planned and actually being implemented in the first, you know, few minutes of it being implemented? And you know, all of a sudden now the mainstream media, you know, because from the independent outlets that really gained a head of steam, all of a sudden now people like Dan Rather are coming out and saying things like, well, you know, we were necklaced by this mandate from the top that it was unpatriotic, you know, that we shouldn't question the government, what the government was doing, because it was unpatriotic. First of all, I thought the reference to necklacing was grotesque when you consider its origin,
right?
You know, people trying to gain their freedom in South America. But secondly, I mean, the guy was basically saying, oh, well, we were afraid to stand up. Why? Because he was going to lose $10 million a year or something? I mean, I don't know why. But, you know, the fact that the mainstream media collectively refused to ask any questions because they were told from the top that it wasn't unpatriotic is absolutely absurd.
Gary, let me interject here. I mean, when you've been looking, since Christina's brought up the past 9 or 10 months and the new war on terrorism, sitting out there in California consuming the news media, as I'm sure you still do, what sort of stories do you think, if you sort of thought, this is a great story someone should jump on, this is really what a good journalist should go after that hasn't been covered?
Number one, that anthrax scare that happened right as the Patriot Act was working its way through Congress, I still think is a fantastic story.
Yes, it is.
And I have seen nibbles by, you know, people dipping their toe in the water, wondering, well, maybe this. First of all, I actually did a proposal for a magazine on this story, and I looked at the media coverage of this right after it happened, and there were so many weird questions and so many weird statements popping up, and nobody seemed to go after them. And it backed off for a while, and then a couple of newspapers started dipping their toe into this topic area. But that is a story that has like dropped off the radar screen. And the last stories I read were people were beginning to suspect, at least inside the FBI, that there was some kind of government involvement in this anthrax scare, which, when you look at the timing of it, and you put it on a timeline of what else was going on, it is very strange.
Well, you know, when you don't have stories like that covered, it only breeds people wanting to speculate because they have no way of knowing. So it leaves it open to what might be wild flights of fancy, but since there's no real coverage, you have no way of knowing.
I have not seen any coverage of that, and that was the number one topic of discussion in America for a month.
Yeah, that's right.
Last year.
The last thing I saw, and this is actually in the British press, said that the caliber of anthrax used, I think in the batch that was sent to Daschle's office, was of such an extraordinarily high grade it could only be made in a very small number.
That's
of
absolutely true.
Of military.
Yeah.
That you stopped hearing about the anthrax the minute that
it started pointing towards a certain direction.
Well, the minute it started pointing at being a local, in other words, here, national as opposed to out from Iraq or someplace.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second that you started hearing that it was possibly, I mean, the FBI acknowledged that the U.S. military had been making the weaponized anthrax that matched the anthrax lacing some of those letters, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they did admit that. And they said that and the BBC report, which was on, I guess, October 10th of last year, were saying that the initial tests of anthrax found in Florida matched strains that were produced for research purposes in the 1950s at a lab in Iowa.
Yeah,
so
Go ahead. Yeah, that was the initial story, and it turned out to be true. It was called the Ames strain, and it was developed specifically in Iowa. But what we ended up with, and I think the state of the knowledge at this point is this anthrax that was used was sort of a research highly atomized. It was very, very finely milled, and there were only a few government labs in the world that can do it. And
one was that Dugway, that Dugway proving ground
right.
in Utah.
Right. There was Dugway proving ground in Utah. There was Fort Detrick, Maryland, which is where the CIA made all their anthrax and stored a lot of their anthrax. If you go back and look at some of the hearings from the Church Committee back in the 70s, there's a big section in there on the CIA making anthrax at Fort Detrick, Maryland, which is where a lot of bioweapons research came from. So I noticed that the stories began dropping off dramatically after, you know, it started looking like it was the anthrax came from a government lab and was made by a very, very sophisticated scientist somewhere, and done in such a way that nobody could figure out where it came from.
Yeah, yeah. Any other stories offhand, Gary, that jump out at you?
The other one that I've been following mostly on the internet through Agence France-Presse has been the trial in South Africa of Wouter Bassin, Dr. Death.
Please, I've got a feeling a lot of our listeners will not be familiar with this.
This is this was a trial that occurred because, and I first started paying attention to it because you had a government scientist in the South African government making mandrax and making ecstasy and selling it for money, which was sort of intrigued me because everybody was telling me that there's no way governments can be involved in drug manufacturing, and then this fellow was arrested. And then slowly but surely this story came out about this thing called Project Coast, which the South African intelligence services and the South African government were running, in which they were experimenting with drugs to try to kill black people. They were developing this super dog to hunt down gorillas. It was like some Frankenstein's lab thing down there. And the only paper that covered it to any degree, the only news service that covered it to any degree, was the French press service. And I always thought that was an amazing story, especially since, at least the stories that I read, had some pretty conclusive links from this program to people in the U.S. government. And the L.A. Times did one story on that topic and then dropped it, never appeared again. And I've never seen the story anywhere.
Was this back in the 80s?
This was back in the 80s when all the Iran-Contra stuff was going on, when the Reagan administration was in power, and when the South African government was trying to figure out how to eradicate its political opposition.
Mm-hmm.
And the fellow was brought up. There was testimony that they had tied people to trees and put special gases, injected them with special chemicals. It was like a Mengele operation almost. And I thought something like this would be receive a lot of national attention, and it didn't. And eventually the doctor that was in charge of all this stuff was acquitted.
Was the trial in Mississippi?
No, it was in South Africa.
Oh.
It was in South Africa by a judge who was a former military judge, I think.
You're listening to Gary Webb and Christina Borgeson. Today on Media Matters, I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have plenty of time for calls. The lines are open. The number is 333-9455. For local calls, 800-222-9455 for toll-free calls. Christina, let's talk a little bit about a book for a second, because the first caller mentioned Greg Palast. There is a chapter by Palast in the book.
Yes, and it deals with exactly what the caller was talking about, the election fraud. And what's interesting about about that story was after he had uncovered the proof, and of course it was a timely story because he had uncovered it all before the election, you know, was finished, you know, and at a time when it could have made a difference. And he contacted CBS, and a producer said she was very interested, and then called him back subsequently to tell him no, she wasn't interested in the story anymore because she called Jeb Bush's office and they denied it.
Well, that certainly settles it. That makes your job easy when you can just get those single, quick answers.
Well, you understand, that is one of the biggest problems. It's certainly a problem that I had when I was trying to, you know, deal when I ran into the buzzsaw with my story researching, you know, the demise of TWA 800, and that is the, quote, legitimate news source problem, which is, and this is how, and this is how the major networks and papers get around having to report anything substantive. As long as the person, if you know, whether it's a government agency or a business agency or some other independent agency, if the person has a title and is speaking in an official capacity, they can lie up one way and down the other, and they will not be questioned. And this is particularly horrendous when you're talking about very, very sensitive stories.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, yes, FBI spokesman, CIA spokesman, as we all well know, our presidents have no problem looking us in the eye or looking the cameras in the eye and lying to the whole nation about anything. You know, it
That's
happens
right.
all the time.
We're talking to Christina Borgeson and Gary Webb here in Media Matters. Please call us at 333-9455. We've got a caller right now from Urbana. Hi, you're on the air. What would you like to say?
Hello?
Yes.
I had a question about a different subject, and that was the crematorium scam, and why the question was never raised as to whether funeral homes in the area were involved. Could you comment on that?
Now, are you talking about that guy who was actually burying people?
That's right, saving a little money and presumably pocketing it.
I remember, oh.
And it's been going on, apparently his father had started it or something.
You know, I only know what I read in the newspapers and saw on television about that. I really don't know any more than that. But the fact that you have a question about it tells me that maybe there wasn't enough reporting done on it.
Well, there was a little reporting done for a while, and then we had the same thing happen out here in California a few years back, where they were just piling bodies in a warehouse because they didn't want to spend the money to bury them. Ironically, my father was an investigator before he died. He was an investigator for the state of Florida, and one of the places he investigated were funeral homes. And he used to tell me the most amazing stories about things that would go on in funeral homes, you know, straight out of the concentration camps, you know, pulling gold teeth out with pliers and throwing ashes in the garbage and mixing them with other people's ashes. And the funeral industry, well, you know, all you need to do is look at Jessica Mitford's book.
Remember that?
The American Way of Death, which is still a classic of investigative reporting.
Yes.
And I don't think much has changed since then. They've become a little slicker, but I
mm-hmm.
you see things.
Caller, did you have another question you wanted to?
I tend not to read a lot or even believe much that I do, but I ask why certain questions haven't been asked or continued to be asked. That is another subject is on
once something falls off the titillation screen for the national media, they sort of forget about it. The local media in Georgia, I would imagine the Atlanta Constitution is still covering the hell out of that thing. But since people out of Atlanta don't get the Constitution, they probably don't know what's going on. And the national media is tired of the story because, you know, they're on to Chandra Levy's body now. So,
but was there another question, issue that you were asking about?
That's enough.
All right, well, thank you very much. Well, let's go. No, I mentioned at the outset of the show, Christina, that you know, the Bias book by Goldberg, which
yes.
alleges, you know, he's a former CBS producer, much like you.
Oh yes.
Did you know him?
Well, I never worked with Bernie.
Okay, but his book alleges that CBS News had a liberal or left-wing political bias on certain types of issues, and it's you know, it's become a number one bestseller. It's been reviewed extensively in all the leading news media.
Uh-huh.
President Bush has been seen carrying a copy of the book under his arm.
Yeah. Oh, boy, that would be so embarrassing.
Well,
you
know,
author and he was...
it's interesting because, you know, my colleagues from CBS still call me from time to time, and it was very politically incorrect to even own a copy of the book, much less read it over there, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And one of my colleagues, who's a correspondent, called me and asked me, what I thought of the book, you know. And, you know, Bernie is a well-known, and this is not to cast aspersions on him as a person or whatever. I'm just telling you, you know, the general reputation was that he was quite the curmudgeon, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when I read his book, the first thing that just struck me in the face, sometimes it's hard to even get to the message because just the tone. The vitriol was way, way, way off the charts. I mean, ripping Dan's face off, you know, and asking all these rhetorical questions and so on. It completely turned me off. Having said that, you know, he did make a couple of very good points about some bad reporting. He did have a couple of good examples. But apart from that, I just feel that he completely, I mean, this business about the liberal press, I mean, a lot of reporters are liberal. I mean, that's, I don't think that, you know, there's, except for, you know, I mean, if you go to Fox, I don't think that's the case. But
you know,
a lot of the network reporters are liberal, and, you know, that's fine. And my whole attitude towards liberal, conservative, whatever is, I don't care what wing the truth flies in on, as long as it's the truth, you know? And that's how I feel about Bernie Goldberg. But having said that, to say that the liberal is media is just so false. It's just totally false. Because he's talking about what's reported, fine, but there is an entire body of information that in a truly democratic society you would hear about, particularly about the military, law enforcement, you know, high-level government malfeasance, high-level corporate malfeasance, or even not-so-high-level corporate malfeasance. There's a whole body of information that you don't get. There's a line beyond which it's total censorship, which is what the buzzsaw is about.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, for the most part, conservatively dictated.
And what's striking, though, is, you know, Bernie's book, Bias, as I said, I mean, it's gotten a lot of play. Your book came out roughly the same time. It includes in it people like Gary, who's won, you know, 30 journalism awards, and just a host of other award-winning journalists. And it has it gotten? What sort of response have you gotten for the book?
Look, this book is really a this book has a lot more weight. I mean, that's the bottom line. This book has a lot more weight because it's not just one person jumping up and down and yelling and screaming. It's 18 award-winning journalists and authors, you know, confirming with stories about their own personal experiences, you know, something that nobody wants to say, you know, that nobody in the mainstream media particularly wants the public to know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's literally lifting up the skirts of the mainstream media and letting people take a good hard look at the information they're getting and how they get it, and the information that they're not getting, and why they're not getting it, and what happens to the reporters who try and get it to them.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Christine Borgeson and Gary Webb today on Media Matters. Christine is the editor of Into the Buzzsaw, Leading Journalists Exposed, The Myth of the Free Press, which talks about the buzzsaw that journalists face when they try to cover corporate or government power in any serious or significant manner. Gary Webb, longtime investigative reporter for 19 years, won 30 awards and wrote one of the chapters in the book on one of the most infamous chapters in American journalism history of the past decade, his expose of the CIA and drug dealing that eventually led him to leave journalism. If you'd like to call in, the number here, 333-9455. We do have time for another call or two, or the toll-free number, 800-222-9455. Christina, maybe we could also talk about your chapter now, if we could. I mean, what your epiphany, what led you to want to do this book? I mean, what your personal experience as a journalist was?
Well, I was at CBS, and I was assigned to cover the demise of TWA 800. And, you know, basically what happened, I was working with a law enforcement consultant who was a former...
Let's back up a second to refresh everyone's memory on what that TWA flight was.
TWA Flight 800 basically exploded in the sky off the coast of Long Island back in July of 1996. And there was all sorts of speculation about, you know, whether a missile had hit the plane or not. And, of course, the recovery of the plane was handled mostly by the FBI, was controlled by the FBI and handled quite a bit by the military. And anyway, I was assigned to look into it at CBS. And at one point, I had been contacted by this independent investigator called Jim Sanders, who actually did something that no American reporter that I knew of had done, which was penetrate inside the Hangerton at Calverton. And one of the National Transportation Safety Board senior investigators started smuggling papers, documents, and evidence out to him because he thought something, there was a cover-up going on. And so eventually, Jim Sanders sent me this piece of seat foam that had this red residue on it, and he said that the guy inside had said that this red residue had been sprayed across several rows of seats. and that, you know, nobody was looking into it. Nobody was analyzing it. So he had Jim Sanders analyze it, and Jim Sanders had an elemental analysis done. And he came out and told the world that, you know, he checked with some explosives people, some missile people, and they said that it was spent rocket fuel. So he gave it to me, and for 60 minutes I was going to do a story that did my own lab work on it. But I never got a chance to do it because the minute the evidence arrived at CBS, the FBI came down and just took it away. I mean, well, CBS handed it over, which was really, I mean, I couldn't believe it. They just handed it over to the FBI, and 3 weeks later I was out. But then, you know, I was assigned by ABC to look into it, and that things got really weird because at one point while I was in New York City, getting ready to go out to Long Island with my associate producer in her car, our car was broken into, the trunk. I mean, the lock looked intact, but we opened up the trunk, and, you know, she had golf clubs, cameras. We had our notes. I had my notes and the computer, and the only thing that was taken were my notes and the computer. So, you know, that was a little strange. And then eventually the whole series that we were working on, which was an investigative series called Declassified, was shut down because of the one TWA story that caused such a brouhaha in the press for a while, because ABC News was saying, no, you know, we've already responsibly reported that this was a mechanical failure. But, you know, back to the red residue, Jim Kallstrom told Dan Rather on national TV that it was this 3M glue, this red residue. And so in my essay, you know, I showed the elemental analysis for the 3M glue and the elemental analysis for the red residue, and they're two completely different things.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, because Jim Kallstrom told Dan Rather, no, you know, it has nothing to do with spent rocket fuel. It's 3M glue. Dan didn't ask any follow-up questions like, how do you know, what analysis, blah, blah,
yeah,
blah. It was just, okay, thank you very much, and Sanders was blown out of the water. They wouldn't even put... I was the first journalist to have an interview with Sanders. They wouldn't put one frame of his face on CBS. Even when they were doing a story on him, they would not put him on. They wouldn't put. They just showed his a picture of the seat foam because they said, "Oh no, he wasn't a credible source."
Huh. Christina, you know, we've got a couple of callers here, and I want to get them both on before the show's over. So let's go back, if we can, right now to the phone lines. Urbana, you're on the air with Gary Webb and Christina Borgeson. Urbana? Oop. Hello, Urbana. Yeah, please go ahead.
Yeah.
Thank you for waiting.
Certainly have been news from Neptune. It's it's been amazing. I have a question of an estimate here with the... taking the line of march of looking backward and walking forward, the socialist leader in Milwaukee was the leading selling daily paper up through the Second War and prided itself on the kind of journalism that was exposé.
Mm-hmm.
And really, left-wing journalism was this until the Second World War. Not only the leader, there were a lot of other papers. And I'm wondering what you think in the future the chances are of you independent journalists who are doing such wonderful expose stories to actually tie in with a third-party force, let's say the Green Party, rather than being independent but actually having a base. It's just a thought here.
Okay.
But you know what? That defeats the whole purpose of being independent. I mean, people, whenever I talk about this book, the left, right, to me, it's not, the actual reporting is not a political issue. It really, you really have to be completely independent. You really have to be.
Yeah, then the question is, and both of you can answer this or address it, is where do you get the funding then to support this caliber of journalism, like Gary was doing, what you're doing, like the authors in the book are doing, if the commercial system isn't going to support it?
Well, magazines are right now, in my opinion, the best source of investigative reporting out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are a lot of magazines that are doing a good job,
mm-hmm.
But by and large, you don't get it unless you know you're hooked up with like PBS and you can get funding from them.
Mm-hmm.
Or,
you think it's tougher today than 10 years ago, Gary?
Absolutely, absolutely. And the reason is that the that the caliber of reporting has declined to such a level that, that even mildly controversial things people are scared of now. I mean, it used to be that you used to put stuff in the newspaper to create controversy, to get people talking, to get them thinking, to get answers to facts you couldn't as a reporter ferret out. But now it's all reactive.
You know, we've only got a minute left, and we've had someone who's been very patiently waiting from Chicago to talk to you. So let me go to that call if I can. Chicago, you're on the air with Gary Webb and Christina Borgeson.
Hi, wonderful show, and thanks to all three of you for your work. The caller before had a good point about independent alternatives, but funding is a problem. What does it say when people are trained in journalism school to ask questions and then hit a profession that squashes them? Does it go back to journalism school? In Chicago, where I bought Gary Webb's book, Dark Alliance, we've got a group called Chicago Media Watch, and maybe all you can do is form groups locally to focus on where the media are falling down and try to encourage them, needle them to a higher standard.
Listen, I think it's wonderful that you have this group and that it was formed. And I think if good citizens like you did that all around the country, it would actually make a big difference. And about the training for journalists, you know, I'm a graduate of the Columbia School of Journalism, and I just went over there to talk to the investigative, up and coming investigative reporters about this. And you know, the professor there, Sandy Padway, his first lecture to his students is to tell them to start, and you'll excuse my French here, to start an FU fund, because chances are that if you are a really, really good reporter, something like this is going to happen to you. So you have to start your padded, you know, you have to get your financial, start your financial padding from the very, very beginning. And that's what we've come to.
But they shouldn't stop trying anyway.
Yeah, Gary. But Gary, what do you say, Gary, to someone who looks at you and says, "Here you were, this tremendous investigative journalist, won all these awards, broke all these great stories, but you don't have a job in journalism today. Should I even try to beat my head against the wall?"
And my answer is always. Otherwise, the bad guys win. You just can't stop just because the odds are against you. You guys just got to keep going.
Do you see yourself getting back into journalism on a full-time basis?
I see myself, I still do freelance writing, so I'm still in journalism. But I don't see myself getting back into daily journalism anytime soon.
Well, the band has started up, Gary Webb, Christina Borgeson. I want to thank you both so much for being here today to talk about your work and to talk about the new book, Into the Buzzsaw, Leading Journalists Expose the Myth of a Free Press, available at fine bookshops, I hope, everywhere. And it's a real big seller, up under 900 today on Amazon. So the word is getting out that this is a book you should be reading. I'm Bob McChesney, your host. Please join us. The next 5 weeks, we're going to have in-studio tape programs. So sit back and relax to Media Matters. Thank you. Goodbye.